A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about fiber infrastructure, specifically the last mile, and how it plays out in dense urban environments. Big picture, fiber connects the entire internet. You've got cables running across ocean floors, backbones stretching up and down countries. But the real complexity, the contractual and infrastructural mess, lives entirely in that final stretch from the street to your apartment. He's asking about the term fiber to the curb, and then zeroes in on skyscrapers and mega buildings. If a building already has a fiber hookup, is it straightforward to wire every unit?
The short answer is that the inside of a large building is its own miniature last mile problem. Let's start with the term itself, because fiber to the curb is one of those phrases that sounds precise but actually masks the whole taxonomy. The industry uses an alphabet soup. FTTH, FTTB, FTTC, FTTN.
Contested by whom? The ISP versus the building owner.
ISP versus building owner versus other utilities versus the original architects who never planned for fiber. The term you hear in the industry is MDU, multi-dwelling unit, and MDU fiber deployment is a whole subspecialty. In a classic FTTC deployment, the fiber runs to a cabinet or pedestal that sits somewhere on the street, typically serving a cluster of homes.
Marketing doesn't love, we got it most of the way there.
The key insight, FTTC is a compromise architecture. It was never the dream. The dream was fiber all the way to the home, but FTTC let telecoms upgrade speeds without digging up every front yard. That's where the outside plant meets the inside plant, and that boundary is a hard legal line. Everything streetside is the ISP's network regulated by franchise agreements and utility access laws. That's not bad. The bottleneck is the copper segment.
The fiber enters the basement and then stares at a locked door.
Meanwhile, pure fiber, FTTH, is basically future-proof. The fiber itself can handle speeds we haven't commercialized yet just by swapping the electronics at either end. In modern construction, especially in buildings designed after about 2010, there's usually dedicated telecommunications riser space, conduits, cable trays, sometimes full equipment closets on every floor. That's been a real regulatory issue. Providers have been taken to task for marketing FTTC as fiber when the last 200 meters were copper. In some jurisdictions, advertising standards bodies have stepped in, but enforcement is patchy.
Hoping the structural engineer doesn't get angry is the unofficial subtitle of most retrofit projects.
Here's where the first big infrastructure challenge shows up, riser congestion. Conduit space in vertical risers is finite. You've got electrical, plumbing, HVAC, fire suppression, security systems, and then data. Then you enter the world of in-building distribution, which is its own entire discipline. This is where FTTB comes in, fiber to the building, also called fiber to the basement.
I assume you can't just hang fiber off the side of the building?
From that point, you have to get connectivity up to individual apartments. But in most regulated markets, external routing triggers building code issues, aesthetic restrictions, and weather exposure problems. So internal riser pathways are the standard.
You've got this vertical spine. How does it actually branch out to individual apartments?
The most common model in large MDUs is a distributed split architecture. You run a high-count fiber cable up the main riser, anywhere from 12 to 288 individual fiber strands bundled together. At each floor, or sometimes every few floors, you install a fiber distribution hub. That's a small, secure enclosure, maybe the size of a briefcase, where individual fibers from the main riser cable are split out and connected to drop cables that run horizontally to each apartment.
It's literally the hub-and-spoke model Daniel mentioned, but for connectivity rather than smart hotel room controllers.
The terminology varies by region. Fiber distribution hub in North America, floor distribution point in Europe. But the concept is identical, a central vertical spine with horizontal branches at each floor.
What's the actual hardware inside one of those floor-level boxes?
Mostly passive optical components. Optical splitters, which take one incoming fiber and split the signal to multiple outgoing fibers, typically 1 to 8, 1 to 16, or 1 to 32 splits. Connector panels for patching. Maybe splice trays where fibers are physically fused together. The key thing is that in a passive optical network, which is what most fiber-to-the-home deployments use, there's no powered equipment on the floor. No switches, no routers, no amplifiers. It's all passive glass and plastic, which means nothing to maintain, nothing to break, nothing that needs a power outlet.
Passive optical network. That's PON, right?
PON is the dominant architecture for residential fiber. The alternative would be active Ethernet, where you run dedicated fibers to each unit from a powered switch somewhere in the building. Active Ethernet gives you higher dedicated bandwidth per subscriber, but it costs more, requires powered equipment rooms on multiple floors, and adds maintenance complexity. For most residential deployments, PON wins on economics.
If I'm a developer building a new 50-story residential tower, I just spec this into the plans and everything's clean. But what about existing buildings?
That's where the contractual and infrastructural boundaries really bite. When an ISP wants to wire an existing building, they need a right-of-entry agreement with the building owner, a contract granting permission to access the building, install equipment, and maintain it over time. And these agreements are negotiated building by building.
Building by building. So there's no standardized framework?
There are attempts. The FCC has pushed for MDU access reform. The European Union's Broadband Cost Reduction Directive tries to streamline things. But in practice, every building owner has their own concerns, their own existing contracts, and their own leverage. A building with 500 high-income tenants is a much more attractive negotiating partner than a 12-unit walk-up.
I assume some building owners see this as a revenue opportunity rather than an infrastructure project.
On one end, you have building owners who treat fiber connectivity as an amenity that increases property values. They actively court ISPs and make access easy. On the other end, you have owners who treat access as a revenue stream. They charge ISPs monthly per-subscriber fees, demand exclusivity payments, or require revenue sharing on service contracts. Some buildings have exclusive marketing agreements where only one ISP is allowed to serve the building, and that ISP pays for the privilege.
The building becomes a miniature monopoly zone.
A micromonopoly, yes. And that's a real consumer protection issue. The FCC banned exclusive MDU agreements for video services back in 2007, and there's been ongoing debate about extending similar rules to broadband. But enforcement is spotty, and plenty of buildings still operate under de facto exclusivity because the owner simply refuses to grant access to competing ISPs.
The landlord is a toll booth operator. Which brings us to something Daniel was hinting at, the difference between getting the building connected and getting an individual apartment connected. Once the fiber is in the basement and the riser is wired, is hooking up Unit 407 still a whole production?
It depends heavily on whether the building was pre-wired during construction. If it was, connecting a new tenant is often a 15-minute job. The fiber drop to that unit is already in place. It's been sitting behind a blank wall plate or in a utility closet since the building went up. The technician just needs to connect the drop at the floor distribution hub, install the optical network terminal in the apartment, and activate the service.
And if it wasn't pre-wired?
Then you're looking at a multi-hour installation that involves drilling through walls, fishing cable through conduits, and potentially running surface, mount raceway along baseboards. In a concrete and steel high-rise, drilling through walls is not casual. You need permission from building management. You might need to coordinate with structural engineers. And you definitely need to avoid hitting electrical conduits, plumbing, or post-tension cables.
Post-tension cables. Those are the high-tension steel cables running through concrete slabs.
And if you drill through one of those, you've just compromised the structural integrity of the floor slab. The repair cost can run into six figures. So installers working in concrete buildings use ground-penetrating radar to scan before drilling. It adds time and cost to every installation.
In a pre-wired building, the marginal cost of connecting a new tenant is negligible. In a non-pre-wired building, it's substantial, which creates a weird incentive dynamic. The developer who pre-wires captures none of that future savings, and the tenant who moves in 5 years later pays the cost of the developer's decision.
That's exactly the split incentive problem, and it's one of the central challenges in building infrastructure. The developer optimizes for construction cost, not operational cost. Pre-wiring a 50-story building with fiber drops to every unit might add somewhere between $50 and $200 per unit to construction costs. That's trivial in the context of a $500,000 condo, but developers operating on thin margins still resist it because it's an upfront cost with no direct return at sale.
$50 to $200 per unit. That's the we-didn't-bother tax that future tenants pay with every installation.
It gets worse when you consider that retrofitting after the fact costs far more. That's time, money, and coordination with the pole owner, which might be the electric company, the phone company, or the municipality. Each has its own process. The cumulative retrofit cost across all units dramatically exceeds what pre-wiring would have cost.
All three layers have to align for a single apartment to get connected.
In a skyscraper, there's a fourth layer, in-building governance. Even if the ISP and the building owner have an agreement, the individual resident might need to coordinate with the building's facilities team to run the final drop from the floor, level distribution point to their unit.
Let's talk about Israel specifically, since that's our context. What's the landscape there?
Israel is an interesting case study because the market structure is unusual. Bezeq, the legacy telecom, historically owned the copper network and had a dominant position. Over the past decade, there's been a major fiber push, with multiple players building out infrastructure. This is why we're seeing a push for fiber-ready building codes. Some jurisdictions now require new multi-dwelling buildings to include fiber conduit and a minimum number of fiber strands per unit as part of the construction permit.
Does that wholesale access extend inside buildings?
That's where it gets complicated. The wholesale obligation generally covers the network up to the building entry point. Exactly the same principle. And the smart developers get this. They're marketing fiber-ready, or pre-wired for gigabit, as an amenity, right alongside the granite countertops and the gym. Because they know that for a certain class of buyer or renter, internet quality is a deal-breaker. If you work from home, you're not going to move into a building where the best available connection is 30 megabit DSL. But implementing that in practice means overcoming the same building owner dynamics we've been describing.
Even with pro-competition regulation, the building owner remains a gatekeeper.
In a high-cost market, that's tens of thousands of dollars. There's a direct financial incentive for building owners to get fiber into their buildings. When a tenant in Unit 407 calls to get fiber service, the service provider might need to coordinate with the infrastructure owner to activate the drop, and also with the building management to get access to the floor distribution hub, and also with the tenant to schedule the in-unit installation. Yes, and it's the dominant model in large buildings. You run a fiber backbone, a riser cable, up through the building. At each floor, or at designated floors, you install a fiber distribution hub, essentially a patch panel and sometimes a switch.
That sounds like a recipe for the kind of appointment windows that ruin your entire Tuesday.
The riser cable is the heavy-duty stuff, often with dozens or hundreds of strands designed to survive in a vertical shaft for decades. It's not uncommon for MDU fiber installations to require multiple truck rolls. One to verify the infrastructure is in place, one to do the actual connection, and sometimes a third to fix something that wasn't done right on the second visit.
Multiple truck rolls. That's an industry term?
In other cases, particularly condominiums, the homeowners association might own the in-building infrastructure and the ISP connects to it at the basement. There's a model called condo fiber, where the building effectively becomes a micro ISP, connecting to one or more upstream providers.
Which circles back to the original question about whether ISPs even want to serve smaller buildings. If a 12-unit building requires the same number of truck rolls as a 200-unit building, the per-subscriber economics are brutal.
And this is why you see ISPs prioritizing large MDUs and why smaller buildings often get left behind in fiber rollouts. The fixed costs of building entry, riser work, and equipment installation get amortized across subscribers. More than you'd think, but also less than you'd fear. There are companies that specialize in managing these setups. They handle the technical operations, billing, customer support. The building owns the fiber but contracts out the operations.
What about the actual physical installation inside the apartment? Once the fiber reaches the unit, what happens?
The fiber terminates at an optical network terminal, the ONT. That's a small powered device, usually about the size of a paperback book, that converts the optical signal to electrical signals for your router. The ONT is the demarcation point between the ISP's network and your home network. Everything upstream of the ONT is the ISP's responsibility. Your router and everything downstream is yours.
The ONT needs power, so it has to be near an outlet.
Yes, and that's a surprisingly annoying constraint. The ideal location for the ONT is near where the fiber enters the unit, which might be in a closet or hallway with no power outlet nearby. Running power to that location adds cost and complexity. Some newer ONT designs support power over fiber, or can be placed farther from the entry point. But it's still a practical friction point.
Let's zoom out for a second. We've talked about the physical infrastructure and the contractual mess, but there's another boundary Daniel mentioned that I want to hit. The boundary between different network segments and who's responsible for what.
In telecom jargon, this is the demarcation hierarchy. At the top level, you've got the international backbone, the submarine cables crossing oceans. Those are owned by consortia of telecom companies and content providers. Google, Meta, Microsoft, and Amazon are all major investors in submarine cable systems now, alongside traditional carriers.
The cloud providers became infrastructure owners because they generate so much traffic that buying capacity from carriers was more expensive than just laying their own cables.
Then you've got national backbones, typically owned by major telecom companies or sometimes government entities. Then metropolitan networks connecting the backbone to individual neighborhoods. Then the last mile from the neighborhood node to the building. Then the in-building riser. Then the horizontal drop to the unit. Then the in-unit wiring.
Each boundary is a potential point of failure, a potential contractual dispute, and a potential bottleneck.
Each boundary has different ownership, different regulatory treatment, and different economic incentives. The submarine cable consortium has completely different concerns than the building owner deciding whether to grant riser access. They're operating in different universes of regulation, technology, and business models.
It's remarkable that the whole thing works at all.
It works because the Internet's architecture is designed to be indifferent to the underlying infrastructure. IP packets don't care whether they're traveling through a submarine cable owned by a Google-led consortium or through a single-mode fiber in a building riser owned by a reluctant landlord. The protocols abstract away the ownership boundaries, but the physical deployment still has to navigate every one of those boundaries.
When something goes wrong, the abstraction breaks down and you're on the phone with your ISP, who's blaming the building owner, who's blaming the infrastructure provider, who's blaming the contractor who drilled through the post-tension cable.
The blame cascade is real. And it's one reason why vertically integrated ISPs, companies that own everything from the backbone to the in-building infrastructure, can offer better troubleshooting experiences. When one company owns the whole chain, there's no finger-pointing. But vertical integration also raises competition concerns, which is why regulators push for wholesale access and infrastructure sharing.
There's a genuine tension between operational simplicity and market competition.
And that tension plays out most acutely at the building level. A building with a single vertically integrated provider gets clean, fast installations and simple support. A building with wholesale-based competition gets lower prices and more choice, but potentially messier installations and more complex support.
Is there a middle ground? Some model that captures the benefits of both?
This is where the concept of open access networks comes in. In an open access model, a single entity owns and operates the passive infrastructure, the fiber, the conduits, the distribution hubs, and multiple service providers compete to deliver services over that infrastructure. The infrastructure owner is neutral. They don't sell retail services. They just provide wholesale access on equal terms to any qualified provider.
Like a utility model for fiber.
Cities like Stockholm, Amsterdam, and Singapore have implemented versions of this. The city or a municipal entity owns the fiber network, and dozens of ISPs compete to offer services over it. The building owner deals with one infrastructure entity, and tenants choose from multiple service providers. It separates the infrastructure problem from the service competition problem.
In a skyscraper context, that would mean one set of riser cables, one set of floor distribution hubs, one set of drop cables to each unit, all owned and maintained by the infrastructure entity, and then tenants pick their ISP from a menu.
and the infrastructure entity has the incentive to pre-wire everything properly because they're amortizing the cost across all potential future subscribers, not just the ones who sign up in the first year. It aligns the long-term infrastructure investment with the operational reality.
Open access networks require either municipal investment or a regulatory framework that makes the economics work for private infrastructure investors. Not every market has that.
Even where the framework exists, the building level dynamics don't disappear. The open access network still needs right of entry agreements with every building owner. It still needs to navigate riser congestion and concrete drilling and the whole physical deployment challenge. The ownership model simplifies the contractual boundaries but doesn't eliminate the physical ones.
We keep coming back to the same point. The inside of the building is a hard problem, regardless of the regulatory or business model wrapped around it.
It's hard because buildings are heterogeneous. Every building has a different floor plan, different construction materials, different riser layouts, different existing infrastructure, different ownership structures, different tenant profiles. There's no standardized solution that works everywhere. Each building is a custom deployment project.
There's something almost comforting about that. All this advanced technology, and the biggest threat is a guy with a shovel. Everything past the curb is bespoke.
Fiber to the curb is often a polite way of saying, we got it close to your building, but the rest is someone else's problem. In some deployments, fiber to the curb means the fiber terminates at a pedestal on the street, and the final connection to the building uses existing copper or coaxial wiring. That avoids the whole building access problem entirely, but it also means you don't get fiber speeds inside the building.
It's a compromise that trades performance for deployment simplicity.
If the nearest fiber node is several blocks away, the cost of trenching or aerial deployment to reach the building might still be prohibitive, even for a large building. The ISP has to weigh installation cost against expected revenue. A 300-unit building with high projected uptake might justify a $1 million trenching project. A 50-unit building in the same location might not.
It's not just the building's size, it's the ratio of size to distance.
Distance costs are highly nonlinear. The first 100 meters from the nearest fiber node might be relatively cheap if there's existing conduit.
The linguistic equivalent of contains real fruit flavor.
Every deployment is its own cost geography.
Which means we end up with a patchwork. One block has fiber, the next one doesn't. One building on the block has it, the one next door doesn't. One apartment in the building has it, the one upstairs doesn't. The last mile is really the last meter. That's true for the external connection, but does the same logic apply inside the building? Does the ISP care about wiring every unit, or do they wire the building and then take a wait-and-see approach?
In the backbone and middle mile segments, you've got high capacity, lots of competition, and reasonable prices. In the last mile, you've got natural monopoly characteristics. It doesn't make sense to dig up the street five times for five different providers, and high barriers to entry.
They might actually refuse to connect a specific unit if the installation looks too expensive.
They might not refuse outright, but they might quote an installation fee that makes the subscriber think twice. Mixed is generous. Some municipal broadband projects have been spectacular successes. Chattanooga, Tennessee. The city's electric power board built a fiber network that offers 10 gigs symmetrical to every home and business.
Which creates a weird situation where two units in the same building, one floor apart, might have completely different experiences getting fiber service, because one happens to be directly above the riser closet and the other is at the far end of a hallway with no existing conduit path.
The difference usually comes down to execution. Did they build at a reasonable cost? Did they price competitively? Did they market effectively?
Even when the government steps in, the same economic logic applies. You still have to get people to subscribe. The fiber in the ground doesn't generate revenue by itself.
That's the trap. It's easy to get excited about the infrastructure. Digging is visible. Politicians love photo ops with shovels and hard hats. But the unglamorous work is in the operations, the billing systems, the customer support, the maintenance, the marketing. That's where municipal projects often stumble. They underestimate the ongoing operational complexity.
Government is good at digging holes, less good at running call centers.
I think that's a fair summary. Though to be fair, some of the private ISPs aren't exactly beloved for their customer service either. In a properly designed PON network, the optical budget, the allowable loss between the central office and the subscriber's ONT, is typically around 28 to 32 decibels. The skill of making your call is important to us. Sound sincere while keeping you on hold for 45 minutes.
Where does this leave us? Daniel asked about the specifics of fiber delivery and deployment, about the contractual and infrastructural boundaries, about how intra-building connectivity actually works. I think we've painted a picture.
The constraints are almost entirely physical access, contractual permissions, and economics. The glass itself can handle the distance just fine.
The regulatory layer is a patchwork of permits, pole access rules, and building codes. And all of it is invisible to the end user, who just wants Netflix to load. We've built this incredible technology that can send pulses of light through glass strands for kilometers with minimal loss. And the bottleneck is whether a building owner in Manhattan will let a technician into the riser closet on a Tuesday.
The transoceanic cables are, in a sense, simpler. They're point-to-point, owned by consortia with clear governance, engineered to extreme standards. The last mile is messy. It's every building, every street, every landlord, every municipality.
Are there any emerging technologies that might change the in-building deployment equation? Wireless last mile solutions that bypass the riser entirely.
Fixed wireless access is the main alternative. Companies like Verizon and T-Mobile in the U.S. are using 5G millimeter wave and mid-band spectrum to deliver home internet without any physical building entry at all. Never forget the backhoe.
You skip the riser, skip the building owner, skip the drilling, just put a receiver in the window.
In practice, millimeter wave signals don't penetrate building materials well, especially modern low emissivity windows that have metallic coatings for energy efficiency. So the receiver often needs to be mounted outside the window or in a location with clear line of sight to the tower, and performance varies with weather, distance, and network congestion.
It's a trade-off. Easier deployment, less consistent performance.
For many users, that trade-off is perfectly acceptable. If you can get 300 megabits per second over fixed wireless with no installation hassle versus a gigabit over fiber that requires drilling and a 4-hour appointment window, a lot of people will take the wireless option.
Fixed wireless doesn't eliminate the building level dynamics entirely. If you're in a dense urban area with lots of tall buildings, getting line of sight to a tower from the 37th floor might be its own challenge.
Yes, and building owners can still create obstacles. Some buildings restrict antenna installations on balconies or exterior walls. Some HOAs and condo boards have rules about visible equipment. The gatekeeper problem doesn't fully disappear. It just shifts from physical access to aesthetic regulation.
The building owner always finds a way to be involved.
They own the box everyone lives in. They're involved by default.
All right, let's try to synthesize this. If someone is moving into a high-rise apartment and wants fiber internet, what should they actually look for? What questions should they ask?
First question, is the building pre-wired for fiber? If yes, ask which ISPs have infrastructure in the building. Second question, if it's not pre-wired, what's the installation process? Ask the ISP and the building management separately, because you'll get different answers, and the gap between those answers tells you a lot about how painful the process will be.
The gap between the ISP's answer and the building management's answer is a pain index. I like that.
Third question, where does the fiber enter the unit? If it's in a closet with no power outlet, you're going to have an ONT placement problem. Fourth question, is there an exclusive agreement between the building and a particular ISP? If yes, you have no choice of provider, and you should factor that into your decision about living there.
If you're buying rather than renting, these questions become even more important, because you're stuck with the building's infrastructure decisions for the long term.
For condo buyers, I'd add, ask to see the building's telecommunications infrastructure during the viewing. Look for the equipment room. Look for floor distribution points. Ask about the riser pathways. Most buyers never think to do this, but it directly affects your quality of life for years.
The telecom walkthrough is part of the home inspection. That's a practical takeaway.
It's the kind of thing that seems obsessive until you're the one spending 4 hours waiting for a technician who can't finish the installation because the conduit is blocked and they need to reschedule, and now you're taking another day off work.
Infrastructure is invisible until it fails. Then it's the only thing that matters.
That's the thesis of this entire episode, really.
One more thing I want to touch on. Daniel mentioned the hub-and-spoke model from a previous discussion about smart hotels. Is there an analogy worth drawing between structured cabling in hotels and fiber deployment in residential towers?
There is, and the parallel is instructive. In a smart hotel deployment, you typically have a central network core, floor-level gateways that handle local processing, and then room-level controllers that manage individual devices. The architecture is hierarchical and distributed for the same reasons that fiber distribution in a residential tower is hierarchical and distributed. You want to minimize the amount of cabling, you want to isolate failures, and you want to make the system manageable at scale.
In both cases, the floor-level distribution point is the unsung hero that makes the whole thing work.
The floor distribution hub in a fiber network is doing conceptually the same job as the floor gateway in a hotel automation system. It's the point where the vertical spine branches into horizontal distribution. It's the boundary between building-scale infrastructure and unit-scale connectivity.
The difference being that the hotel system has active electronics on each floor, while the fiber distribution hub is passive.
And that passivity is a huge advantage from a maintenance perspective. No software updates, no power supplies, no thermal management. Just glass and plastic doing their job for decades.
That's the other thing about fiber that doesn't get enough attention. Once it's in place, it has extraordinary longevity. The fiber installed today will support speeds we haven't even commercialized yet.
Because the capacity limit is in the electronics at either end, not in the glass itself. The same single-mode fiber that was installed 20 years ago for 1 gigabit service can carry 100 gigabits today with upgraded transceivers. The glass doesn't need to be replaced, the boxes at either end do.
Which makes the upfront deployment decision even more consequential. If a building isn't pre-wired for fiber, it's not just missing out on today's speeds, it's missing out on the next several decades of speed improvements, unless someone pays for an expensive retrofit.
That's why building codes and municipal policies that mandate fiber-ready infrastructure and new construction are so important. They're not about meeting today's needs, they're about not foreclosing tomorrow's possibilities.
The developer who saves $100 per unit by skipping fiber pre-wiring is making a decision that will cost the building's residents thousands of dollars and countless hours of inconvenience over the building's lifetime.
Split incentives again. The developer captures the savings, the residents bear the costs.
Capitalism's greatest hits.
The album never stops selling.
To directly answer the question Daniel posed, in mega buildings, ISPs absolutely bring fiber to specific floors and then branch out to individual apartments. It's not just common, it's the standard architecture. And whether it's straightforward or not depends almost entirely on decisions made during construction. Pre-wired buildings make it trivial. Everything else makes it a custom project with all the coordination headaches we've described.
The contractual boundaries are layered like an onion. International backbone consortiums, national carriers, metropolitan networks, last mile providers, building entry agreements, riser access rights, in-unit installation. Each layer has its own owners, its own incentives, and its own failure modes.
The internet is a triumph of engineering and a disaster of property rights.
That might be the most concise summary of this entire topic. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 20th century, linguists studying Inuktitut in the Arctic widely believed the language exhibited polysynthetic morphology so extreme that a single word could express what required an entire sentence in English, a theory that dominated linguistic typology for decades before researchers realized they had been misanalyzing the data by confusing morphological incorporation with syntactic combination. The theory was largely abandoned by the 1970s, but remains a cautionary tale in the field about the dangers of exoticizing unfamiliar language structures.
Linguists got overexcited and invented a grammatical superpower that didn't exist.
The academic equivalent of seeing a magic trick and spending 40 years building a theory around it before someone asks to see the other hand. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go, from sloth slow takes to facts on cue. We chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.